The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour three, back to regular order, as regular as we can make it. It is a delight and always calming presence to welcome back to the studios Hugh and Lewis Hallman. Hugh Hallman is the former mayor of Tempe. He is an attorney in town and an educator. Lewis Hallman is an educator in town, but also the head managing director of Insight Analytics, LLC, I-N-C-I-T-E, Analytics, LLC. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. It's good to see you again. You have your backs towards David. I have my front towards David. I'm not sure who has it better, but it's regular order.
It is,
and it's
much,
good to be regular.
It is much regular order, and you know, one will have to get into a conversation about eating more bran muffins.
Yeah.
regularity is your issue. But I think we should turn it over to Lewis, who wanted to, in an earlier discussion today with him, wanted to describe the politics of the Israeli attack on an embassy, the Iranian response, and the magic of how that all was handled.
Sure. So last week there was a strike by Iran into Israel consisting of a significant display of strategic weapons. So these would include about 120 drones, mainly the Shahed type, about 30 intermediate-range cruise missiles, and about another 100 long-range ballistic missiles or intermediate-range ballistic missiles. And
that was done in response
to? That was done in response to an attack committed by Israel, where Israel struck the Iranian embassy in Lebanon on the 1st of April. Now, in that attack, Israel successfully eliminated an Iranian brigadier general attached to the Quds Force.
You mean Syria.
You said Libya.
Oh, excuse me.
Wow. Lebanon, no.
Excuse me. In Lebanon. Yeah. The embassy in Lebanon, the Iranian brigadier general.
I just wanted people to keep
excuse
it straight.
Me.
I didn't mean to be pedantic about
no,
it.
No, no, no. Thank you for correcting me.
Yeah.
So...
Just so
we have an Iranian brigadier general and five of his aides attached to the Quds Force. That's Q-U-D-S. Now, the Quds Force is Iran's arm that operates with sort of paramilitary groups and indigenous forces in other countries to sort of gin up the principally Shia-backed Iranian state's goals in what is otherwise largely Sunni Muslim countries around the Middle East. And so this brigadier general, in fact, was part of the logistical effort to launch the October 7th attack, with which we're all now increasingly familiar. And so we can see, obviously, that Israel has an extreme motivation to retaliate here. Now, attacking an embassy is unusual. It is certainly... not typical in terms of looking at international norms and laws and response. You know, embassies are the sovereign soil of a nation in another nation, effectively, and it's very unusual for them to become military targets. But Israel then launched this very limited attack and killed this brigadier general. So
a guy who was responsible for the logistics and murdering Jews on October 7th.
Correct. And so... From that, then, Iran now has had its embassy attacked in another country and is in a political position where it then has to respond or it loses face domestically and within its own governmental structure. And so now we have this challenge where Israel... Very rightly, I would argue, has retaliated against Iran, and Iran is now in a position where it is now left looking weak and silly if it does nothing. And so Iran obviously then is obligated to respond. And so it then does this. It arranges over the next couple of weeks this strategic strike that occurred last week. Now, the results of that strike are
not well reported, but go ahead, Lou.
So the results of that strike are very interesting. Between somewhere around 95% of the munitions were intercepted before they got to Israel by a combination of U.S., Israeli missile defenses, as well as, I believe, the Jordanian Air Force and several other parties. As the weapons traveled through other countries, the defenders of those areas, Jordanian Air Force and the like, obviously they don't want to tolerate missiles flying through their airspace, so they sent up fighters to engage. And in total, about 95% of that strike was taken out. And the damage in Israel was, though regrettable, not something that I think is likely to escalate into a protracted tit-for-tat conflict, much in the same way that we see sort of between Israel and Hamas right now.
Because?
Well, because what has happened is that Iran effectively has gotten carte blanche, sort of a tacit permission. They, in fact, telegraphed to Israel before the attack occurred and the United States that they would be launching the attack so that civilians and the likes could be evacuated, moved, and damage minimized. So why do this, right? Isn't that a really interesting thing? These two countries are absolutely hateful towards one another, and Iran frequently calls upon for the destruction of Israel. So why would they show restraint? Well, the answer is that possibly Iran is not ready right now to jump off into a full World War III style invasion, and that this is a political matter that has to be responded to. That's one part of it. The second part of it, though, is that by launching these specific weapons and not a suite of the significantly more common older pieces in its inventory, Iran was able to test its newest systems in a live-fire environment against the actual defensive capabilities it would be required to face. That is a very rare opportunity for any kind of weapons developer to get that kind of battlefield testing. And it's also why watching what goes on in the Ukraine war right now and increasingly, I think, in Gaza and in Israel is so relevant for the future of armed conflict. We are changing the way that warfare works, and we fail to keep up with these trends at our peril.
Your point really is you've got an orchestrated once Israel had made the decision to attack the embassy and kill the lieutenant colonel?
The brigadier general.
Brigadier general. Who had helped to orchestrate the attacks on Israel, a justifiable move. So that the embassy was housing somebody who'd been that strategically important to the attack on Israel doesn't really give Iran much protection, but in fact, arguably, is the same as Hamas using Palestinian civilians as protection. But I think your main point is the thing we need to consider is Iran then structured a response that it telegraphed to the U.S. and Israel, and that the U.S. intended to have a stand down thereafter. So one can imagine the structuring that might have taken place with the Biden White House and administration and Iran that allowed Iran to test its best military equipment to, unfortunate for Israel and the U.S., find out how it operates in response to these defensive measures and how ultimately they might overcome those defensive measures. Similarly, the U.S. and Israel get to see how Iran's best weapon systems work,
right,
and get to then think about how they might be improved in a way that Israel and the U.S. need to enhance Iron Dome and other defensive strategic pieces. Because immediately following the attack, Israel then had to ponder its response. It then took a response, and both Israel and Iran said the matter is now closed.
Right.
A very unusual moment in international history that you had two warring bodies that dislike one another that intensely run a theater exercise,
right,
in real military weaponry, and then each declare to their own side victory without rubbing the other's nose in it so that there would be no further action taken, arguably. And I wonder the extent to which the Biden administration was involved in this orchestration.
So I love the characterization of sort of the cruise missile kabuki that we're dealing with here. And
one for Lou, cruise missile kabuki.
I'll take it. But what also is so interesting about this whole exercise is the degree to which you have to consider the opposition's political standing and how it is perceived by its own population, right? There's actually a really delicate political dance happening at both ends of this exchange. And one of the things that's very easy for armchair generals to forget is that the enemy has a theory of victory itself. And unless your plan incorporates the existing enemy's theory of victory with an idea of how to additionally turn that on its head and overcome it, you haven't guaranteed victory yet. You are still up in the air and you are still rolling the dice.
Let me add a few things to what you said. Thanks for that analysis when we come right back, and then we'll take it from where that operates forward to what we're seeing on the streets of the United States as well. Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman are my guests, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman are my guests, coming in with the Rockford theme song. Have you ever called young David on his cell phone, Hugh?
I have not. Is that what I get?
It's worth doing it. No, he gives you the full taping, the opening with the, "Hi, this is Dave Dahl. I'm sorry, I can't take your call right now at the tone. Leave your name and number. I'll get back to you." And then it goes into the music. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Very nice.
Yeah. Thank you for that recital of an analysis of what took place with the Israeli killing of General Zahedi, and then Iran's response to it, and then Israel's what we might call sir reply. Fair enough? Sir reply?
Reply would be good enough.
Reply would be good enough. A couple thoughts. First of all, we do use the word embassy a little loosely, I think. It was a consulate, not an embassy. And there is a distinction legally about the sovereignty of whether Iran actually had
great
sovereign
catch. Thank you, sir.
And that's really – it's a small part. That leads to a bigger part that Hugh was kind of pointing to, which is – once a designated terrorist enters a protected facility, is that facility still protected, or has it been converted into a part of the field of war?
A vehicle of war.
Yeah, has it become part of the battlefield? And I think most international lawyers will agree that if it's done knowingly, that you lose certain of your protective status. And of course, the IRGC, excuse me, as well as the Quds Force, are not only on Israel's designated terrorist organization list, and not only is Israel and Iran in a state of war, but they're on America's designated terrorist. So correct. A terrorist was killed in a consulate by Israel, who was involved in planning the October 7th attacks. The Iranians and Israel then had this volley, as you say, and Iran tested its powers against Iron Dome, and also probably tested whether it had Arab allies anymore.
Right. Iron Dome, by the way, is the very, very short-range anti-rocket defense. There are a number of other integrated systems above Israel, but happy to use Iron Dome as the short hand for all of them.
Israel's civilian and military defense systems, aerial defense systems. But it was also a test, I think, of the Arab states and where they were vis-a-vis whose side they were going to be on. And I think the most interesting part of the story is that Jordan sided with Israel.
I absolutely agree.
That is the underreported story here.
Well, they have objected to that characterization very lightly.
I know.
Because they want to stay friends with
the
U.S.
Sure.
And said, no, we were just stopping stuff from flying through our airspace, which is how Lewis proposed it in his analysis.
Sure.
But we could count on Jordan doing that for that point. Sorry.
Yeah, no, let me just keep going.
Keep going.
The point being, given everything Jordan had been saying in condemnation of Israel and that had joined previous wars to liquidate Israel more recently in 1973 and 1967, it was a remarkable feat that they chose whatever pretext they wanted to actually not join in this attempt to liquidate Israel for the first time in its military history. The question then quickly became, my God, are we about to enter World War III with Israel's response? And would Israel respond? And if they responded, what would the response look like? And could it lead to an Armageddon? Iran and every other power that deals with Israel understands that Israel is a nuclear power. What Israel equally understands is that Iran is a heavily terrorist, organized power, which cannot really do much any more than the United States could do much if they activated their cells, including Hezbollah. It is a sitting duck if Hezbollah wanted to activate. So there's this tension, and it involves the United States because we assume there are Hezbollah cells in this country. So the question was, would Israel even respond? The response, I thought, was about as perfect as it could be. Because what that response was in taking out the aerial defense systems of the Natanz nuclear facility, which is what is causing everyone so much concern in Iran, is it said we can, A, touch you, and B, we can now touch your nuclear facility because we took out your air defenses protecting it. Now, Iran then immediately said that Israel's mission was a failure. The moment they said that, we knew it was over. Because what we then knew was Iran was telling the international community as well as its own people that there's no need for us to respond to a failed attack.
Exactly right.
So it got them the ability to save face. The last thing I want to say is the last thing I ever want to hear from Iran is that embassies should be protected. Iran's entire existence comes from an attack and hostage taking and killing of a U.S. protected embassy in Iran. And they have attacked embassies throughout the world to kill Jews. In Argentina, they have made attempts in Bangladesh. They tried to blow up a restaurant in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. in 2009. They get no cover in saying certain areas are off limits in the war that they have used as their calling card. But I think for now we're calm. The question becomes, really, in the future, is Iran going to further trying to activate here? But they also look like, I think, a spent force. I mean, I think it was an immediately embarrassing moment for Iran. Yes, sir. That's my supplemental
thought.
Well,
I think you're absolutely right. And I'm not going to argue with you about whether it's an embassy or a consulate or any other protected property.
It may not matter.
It didn't matter in this instance because they had violated it by housing a terrorist.
Right.
And so you notice the international press and the international legal community and the rest of the internationalists involved said nothing about that issue.
Right.
It never got any traction.
So interesting.
And Iran did not even attempt it.
Yeah.
That's point one. Point two, I think you've made exactly right, that Iran has huge terrorist forces planted throughout the world. And that's what I want to bring us to in the next segment. Because what I think we should be recognizing in the domestic problems we're facing is that we've had a very leftist band take over our universities throughout this country, that we have been teaching the kinds of philosophies that have eliminated support for Western ideology and philosophy and replaced it with these terrorist notions of right and wrong. And we now see it across our country. And you are the one who pointed out to me that I did not see myself. The Wall Street Journal opinion piece titled "Who's Behind the Anti-Israel Protests?" Talking about the placement of terrorist organizations and terrorists within the United States that are actively recruiting young people to behave the way we're seeing them behave on television, and that these children have no understanding of the broader implications and the broader philosophies underlying what's going on. And you've got the terrorist organizations housed in the Middle East crowing about this effort, that they have successfully used social media and infiltrated, I think is the right word, the U.S. and the West generally to change the narrative that Israel is worth preserving and that Jews are somehow occupiers and colonialists in Israel.
Yes, let's do that when we come back, because that piece in the Wall Street Journal, what's it titled again? I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me.
Who's behind the anti-Israel protests?
Must reading, and I did link to it on Twitter for those of you following me on Twix, I should say, because it's a documentation of the invocation, or the necessary, I should think, invocation of many federal investigations into what's going onto these campuses. Tom Cotton picked up on some of it today with 25 other senators, but he left out something interesting, which is a very important statute, which is the material support for terrorism statute, which if Merrick Garland or Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or anyone at the FBI had any concern about enforcing, would be all over the place on these campuses. But we'll come back on that when we come right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman are my guests. We're talking about Israel and its war and America and its colleges and universities. And Lewis, you wanted to do a little cleanup on me on aisle 6.
Well, a little bit here. Well, before we get too deeply into that, I want to ask, notionally, why would someone be a student in the first place? Right? Ostensibly, unless I'm wildly out of touch, one would go to college to learn additional set of skills because one's education and worldview is fundamentally incomplete. And that ideally the experience of going and learning about hard things that you don't have context about would then make you a fuller person so that on the other side you can go into our democratic republic as a functioning, you know, game theoretically bound, reasonable voting human being. And so what is wild to me then is that so much of the arguments that we have about this, and really any conversation, depend on when you decide to hit start, you know, when you're discussing the narrative of whatever grievance we're debating or talking about. And so it's so easy for contextless 18-year-olds who have no idea about anything, who then read the headline, "Israel bombed an Iranian embassy," to then go, "Oh, Israel must be the bad guy. They're clearly the aggressor in the headline," because they didn't start the story at the appropriate place and they have no idea when and how to begin that analysis. That's the entire reason they're at school. And yet we seem to be in a place culturally since the 60s that student-led protests by these definitionally know-nothing moralizers, they should be the one to give us moral clarity, and that we should allow them to drag the Overton window around with us and pull us all along by our nose hairs.
And I think to make the point clearer, you've then got two handmaidens that are leading those students astray. A liberal news media that is creating the headlines that would set the moment of start for these students, and university faculty members who would then continue to feed into it their political philosophy. I listened to a competing station on my way here, as we have talked, we do, NPR, with the BBC interviewing a faculty member from NYU who was also arrested with the students for protesting NYU. And his entire narrative was that, of course, every protester on the Palestinian side has been peaceful. There has been not a single threat. There's been not a single moment of violence in any of the protests in the United States or the West by Palestinian, pro-Palestinian protesters, which is nonsense. And we can talk about that in the details. But that's what we've got. So students who don't understand, who go to college to learn, are being taught by people who are giving them a political narrative that is anti-Western. And then that is being emphasized by a news media that is following in the same path.
You both put a finger on something very important here that I've been wrestling with. Do they know what they're talking about? Was part of the theme of both your comments. What is their context? What is their knowledge? First of all, the professors are odd as hell. These professors I saw yesterday would not talk to the press, as if almost they were afraid of the questions. It's odd to me how much they want to stand there but not be asked about what they're standing for.
Defending the indefensible in public is a radically difficult thing to do.
And it begs this question, or it raises this question in my mind about both the faculty and the students. I can't get it out. I thought of it when I was driving by the protesters on 32nd Street the other day. In 5 years, will these people look back and say, what the hell was I thinking? The way people who supported Germany in the 30s looked back by 1945. Will they, or like perhaps those who supported Stalin in the 40s and 50s, started saying at the end of the 1950s, what the hell was I thinking? Are they going to say that when they look back at the kinds of regimes they were marching for and exercising civil liberties on behalf of, and some uncivil liberties? Or do they actually know what they're doing and know what they're supporting? And that's what I can't fully figure out. I think when they invoke some of the nastier epithets, and when they charge and falsely imprison some of the students, that tends to lean more towards a knowing motive. But for the vast majority of them, I just don't know if they're idiots in fact or idiots morally. I can't tell. And maybe you can help me unwind some of that concern, if that made any sense.
Oh, I want to pick up on that so badly when we come back.
Right, fair enough.
We may not get to anything else.
We may not. we could find another hour, but no one would hear
it.
If
only.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman and Hugh Hallman are my guests. Lewis.
So, Seth, you closed out the last segment with a really interesting question, and it was, will the students that are marching, defending the indefensible today, you know, will they in 5 years' time be able, will they have the capacity to look back and say, what on earth was I thinking? And you sort of made the analogy to the Germans after 1945 or the Russians.
Or the Americans supporting Germany.
Sure, sure.
Right, right.
Or, you know, or what have you. And in my mind, it's not obvious to me, particularly, you know, the Americans supporting Germany who are loosely associated with it, we'll leave aside. But if we talk about Germany itself, it's not obvious to me how many true former Nazis repented.
Okay.
Because what you had at that society, you had deeply, deeply totalitarian impulses in both West and East Germany for a number of decades. And what I think you have is the modern day Germany is not created through an act of apology by those that perpetrated, you know, the sins of the Holocaust. I think it was created by their children reacting in horror and running as far away from that as possible. Never once did the perpetrators, I think, really apologize, but their children saw what their parents had done and reoriented the society in another way. So there is no self-referential acknowledgement. There is no, I did something wrong and I need to heal. It's my society in the past, it did something wrong. I worry that that's about as much as we have the capacity for earnest and honest self-reflection as a species. It is very rare to see a monster truly repent in any real way.
And I'd add to that. And I think you've given the best example in human history where even somebody acknowledged the horrors of the past, and it is the German society. But even those children aren't saying my parents. They're saying, you know, people in this society, and
right.
I abhor
there's
that.
There's a distancing that always has to happen because they, you know, you don't want to think that you can be that level of monster.
And I would go to an example in the U.S., more recent history. You had the protesters, the same kinds of collegiate protesters on college campuses decrying the Vietnam War. These are the very same people from the same cloth who would now decry the failure of the United States to engage in saving people from various genocides. And you can, over the last 30 years, there have been plenty of them. And yet, those were the people who were decrying the U.S. involvement in Vietnam that when we pulled out, up to 10 million people in Cambodia were murdered. A genocide by a crazy Pol Pot regime that decided that anybody of any intellectual heft needed to be killed. And yet none of those protesters likely has a conversation with him or herself that says, I was on the wrong side of that. It doesn't happen. And in fact, the reason I think about that was in Year of Living Dangerously. There is an acknowledgement, momentary acknowledgement in that movie of the idea that people force the U.S. to ultimately, as they're now attempting to force the U.S. to pull out of Israel, to pull out of Vietnam. And the answer was, we couldn't have known that that would happen. And that's a lie. We can see the handwriting on the wall when totalitarian regimes, when horrible regimes like Iran seek to murder another group of people. And Hamas pulled that off in Israel, murdering 1,200 people in horrible ways. And yet we've now got kids protesting on campus in the U.S. that are being manipulated by the very same leaders from Iran and other countries in the Middle East with their philosophy being manipulated through social media, etc. And unfortunately, Seth, I do not believe in 5 years, assuming we get around this problem and we preserve Israel and do not abandon Israel, that because if the alternative occurs, then nothing will ever happen. The reason Joseph Stalin and his horror of the Soviet Union that murdered 20 million people was beloved and is still beloved by people in the United States is because he came to our side. So we were with a horrible terrorist who murdered his own people, but at least we defeated the Nazis.
Right, and we can't even reconcile our own part in propping up the USSR.
Correct.
As a consequence of that. There is a, you know, there is a real cost to that.
We should be able to morally, right? I mean, I think Winston Churchill did a pretty able job of it. This is such an interesting thing. The Germany on Germany is
particularly interesting, Lewis, as you
the most extreme example.
It is. And what I want to consider, though, is the American view of these other countries. This notion, Hugh, that people said, well, we didn't know Cambodia would fall, for example, is much akin to people a year ago saying, well, the schools had to be closed because no one knew what was going on. There's this revision of what people knew and didn't know. There were plenty of warnings as to what would happen if we abandoned
South Vietnam. Starting 90 days on this very show in April, May, and June of 2020.
And same with South Vietnam falling.
Correct.
And same with almost every other example. The one thing, one place where there is an accounting, I think there was some with the America First Committee in Germany and its fascination, there was some repentance. The communist repentance, the pro-communist repentance was big. Whitaker Chambers was a fascinating example. Would you allow me a little piece of his
Please,
literature?
And you spend a lot of time focusing on Whitaker Chambers as a good example, and I think he misleads you to the from away from the rest of them.
Okay, that may be.
I think he stands in contrast to the typical.
Maybe an exception that proves the rule. That he was joined by some with that book, The Dream That Failed, but he said, there is one experience with which most sincere ex-communists share whether or not they go only partway to the end of the question it poses. The daughter of a former German diplomat in Moscow was trying to explain to me why her father, who as an enlightened modern man had been extremely pro-communist, had become an implacable anti-communist. It was hard for her because as an enlightened modern girl, she shared the communist vision without being a communist, but she loved her father, and the irrationality of his defection embarrassed her. He was immensely pro-Soviet, she said, and then you will laugh at me, but you must not laugh at my father. One night in Moscow, he heard screams. That's all. Simply one night he heard screams. A child of reason in the 20th century, she knew that there is a logic of the mind. She did not know that the soul has a logic that may be more compelling than the mind. She did not know at all that she had swept away the logic of the mind, the logic of history, the logic of politics, the myth of the 20th century, with five annihilating words. One night he heard screams. His point is, you will ultimately always hear the screams. And there were then, yeah, go ahead. You take the point. Go right ahead.
Well, so here's the only piece I would sort of interject on top of that is that, you know, as we're talking about the notion of being able to self-reflect and earnestly come around when one was previously engaged in something horrific, and it's not clear to me though that anyone has the capacity really to pull themselves out from their own perspective and realize that horror. So specifically with the communist example. I think that it's possible if you weren't lining people up against the wall and pulling the trigger, you have an easier time. If your only sin is marching with other dumb people and saying stupid things, possibly you can say, what was I thinking? But I think there are depths to it.
Will you?
Don't you think?
Yes, totally. And Hugh, can I impose on you to fulfill the thought on the other side of this break that you were making about Whitaker Chambers? And,
I will, and I'm going to give you an example of Whitaker Chambers and another example.
Good. Yeah. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Mucho thanks to Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman for always bringing their subtle brains to this show every Tuesday. The one last point I'll make about Whitaker Chambers before I throw it to you is fascinating in that when he gave up communism, said he thought he was joining the right side but the losing side. And I guess that chapter is yet to be finished. But anyway, I think it's worth pointing out he never thought he was joining the winning side by abandoning communism. Anyway, Hugh.
And you use Whitaker Chambers as an example of someone who saw the light and repented from the horrors of the Soviet Union and what communism wrought for people there. I've spent a lot of time in former Soviet countries, and most particularly, as Lewis and my family know, and your listeners, in Kazakhstan. Just as there are people in the United States, and it's primarily most people in the United States, think of Joseph Stalin as having been our friend and ally in defeating the Nazis. And as a result, he gets a pass. But the reality is he killed three times as many people.
Correct.
As Adolf Hitler did in Nazi Germany, three times as many people. the Republic of Kazakhstan that I go to, Joseph Stalin murdered a quarter of the population. 1.5 million out of 6 million Kazakhs were murdered between 1929 and 1932-33, starved to death intentionally. The same kind of terror in Ukraine. And even in those countries, it is hard to find anybody who will say bad things about Joseph Stalin, because Uncle Joe, as we know him, brought strength and direction and honor in World War II to the Soviet countries, and that was the deal. There are other examples, though, that you want to point out, that there are people who have recognized their error. And the most famous one that I think about happened because Dwight Eisenhower made very clear and public the horrors that had occurred in Nazi Germany by opening the concentration camps and dragging the press in and dragging in the elected officials and political leaders in Germany to see what they had done. And in one instance, the mayor of Goethe went home and committed suicide, which helped propel the narrative of the horrors of Nazi Germany. It took that kind of insight to demonstrate those horrors clearly so that it would be hard to deny. And yet here we sit today with college students running around U.S. campuses having been educated by crazy leftists to abandon Western philosophy and ideology. And those college students are shouting things like "from the river to the sea," which is essentially a call for genocide of Jews in Israel. That's how crazy this has become. We've come full circle, and we are forgetting the lessons of World War II and Nazi Germany, and we cannot let that happen.
Hallmans, bless you. Thank you. Folks, until tomorrow, I am Seth Leibson on behalf of Hugh and Lewis and Mr. Bill and young David and Teresa. God bless you all, and
class dismissed.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.